Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Any Stupid Questions, the podcast where three comedians ask experts in important things, stuff you ought to know but don't. Basically, we'll look ignorant so you don't have to. I'm Danielle Ward and joining us to explain farming this week is Philip Clark, the executive editor of Farmers Weekly. Hello, Philip.
Hello, Danielle.
Also joining me are comedy writer Jack Bernhardt and comedy writer slash producer Clarissa Maycock. Hello.
Hello.
Now, as we've realised, no one listens to the end of podcasts, so if you want to plug anything, you're going to have to do it right now. Jack.
I'm on Twitter. And so look at Twitter, it's a good website.
What is your Twitter handle? That's probably helpful. Has it got lots of numbers after it?
It's got two numbers after it, so it'll be confusing. So it's at JackBurn23.
Larissa, have you got anything you'd like to plug?
Oh, I've also got a Twitter account. I'd love some followers.
What's your Twitter account?
It's at ClarissaDM.
And Philip, have you got a Twitter account?
I do, but it's a fairly passive one, but at Farmers Weekly.
Right, so here's my first question to you, Philip. Will leaving the EU be good for farmers? Because they all seem to be very up for it.
Well, that's a pretty big question to kick off with, but let's give it a go. I think the first thing I'd say was that we were pretty surprised that farmers were up for it. Probably 4 months before the referendum itself, we did our first snap poll on our website, fully expecting farmers to be probably more remain rather than leave. Mm-hmm. And it turned out about 60% leave, 40% remain. We did another four or five pieces of research over the next year and after the referendum as well, and the result was consistent. As for whether that's a good thing or
is it
bad thing
be good for
agriculture, well, we're still mystified.
None of us know.
Yeah. I mean, every bit of research that we'd seen in the run-up and subsequently tends to paint a more negative economic picture. But there again, there was other reasons people voted. They weren't just voting based on, you know, their own economic expectations.
Yeah.
They were voting for reasons of sovereignty or reasons of migration or whatever happened to, you know, float their boat.
And so what is the situation with farmers and EU subsidies? Because we hear about this also. I mean, I was under the impression, I'm surprised that it was that number, because if you listen to Nigel Farage on LBC, he acts like 90% of farmers wanted to leave and it's going to be great for them. And don't even get him started on the fishermen. So what is the situation with the EU subsidies? How does this work?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I don't listen to Nigel Farage on LBC, but
welcome, guys.
Listen, plays all the best hits,
indeed. But in terms of the subsidy issue, then clearly, you know, a lot of farmers' income is derived from the subsidy. In sort of broad terms, on average, about 60% of farm profit is the subsidy, and there's no guarantee that that'll continue. There's a guarantee that it will continue until the end of the current government.
Yeah.
That might be till next week or 2022, who knows? Who knows? But after that, there's no financial commitment. And so, yeah, there's a strong likelihood that the subsidy will be reduced. Without the subsidy, the majority of farmers would be making a loss at the moment. It's, you know, their profitability is very dependent on the money that they get from Brussels and from the taxpayer.
Why does the EU subsidise farmers? That seems like that's probably a very dumb question, and it is a dumb question, and that's the point of the show. But why do they do it?
Well, there's a historic element to it, obviously. So going back to the formation of the common market after the Second World War, there was a national food shortage, and so to boost food production, system subsidies was introduced in Europe. We had a different system in the UK, when we joined the EU in, or the European Economic Community in the early 70s, we merged into their system. But pretty much every country, every developed country in the world has some kind of support system for agriculture. And without it, then your producers are going to be at a significant disadvantage. So there's an element of history and there's an element of doing the same as everybody else.
Am I right in thinking there's an element of preparing for disaster in that historically, that in case there was like World War III, tomorrow we'd still have plenty of food, or is that?
I think if there's World War III tomorrow, we're not going to worry too much about what's going into our stomachs. But historically, that is the case. Recently, in last November, with the armistice, we were looking back at sort of some of the history behind it. And on the eve of the First World War, we were something like 60% self-sufficient in food. Mm. Coincidentally, we're about 60% self-sufficient in food now. But then come 1917, 3 years into the war, there was a real danger that the country was going to starve. And with the German U-boats hitting food supplies that was coming from our colonies then, the government decided that it had to do something. And so it changed the policy fairly late into the First World War to start giving production incentives to enable the country to feed itself. And that argument, you know, can still be applied today in what is a very uncertain world.
So if, let's say, we've left the EU, and so the farmers don't get that subsidy, and then there's a change of government, whichever way it swings, and they say we can't afford to subsidise farming anymore, what happens?
It'll depend on many things. It'll particularly depend on our trading arrangement. It will depend on what other countries are doing as well. The whole thrust of the policy debate at the moment is that, yes, there should still be money available for UK farmers, but what they have to do to qualify will change. And so there's a big emphasis on environmental delivery, animal welfare, public access, what Michael Gove calls public money for public goods. And to a certain extent, that's not a bad thing. Mm. I think, you know, that's the way it's been heading. It's the way the UK has been pushing for change in Brussels over 30 years. It now has more free rein to do so. But if farmers are able to get a better return from the marketplace, and that's a big issue in itself, then, you know, delivering public goods makes sense if that, you know, that's what we have to do to get hold of taxpayer money.
So, like, a pint of milk costs 45p. If I was Alan Sugar selling that pint of milk at a profit because I've made it as a farmer, how much would I have to sell it for?
I don't think the supermarkets are making profit on milk. I mean, historically, it's been a bit of a loss leader anyway. Yeah. But whatever losses the supermarket's making on milk, it's also putting pressure on the supply chain, and the bottom of the supply chain is the farmer. At the moment, they're making a decent enough income from dairying because the world market has been stronger, and things like price of butter, price of cheese on the global market also affects what the dairy farmer makes. But there's been plenty of times in the not-so-distant past when dairy farmers have been losing money hand over fist, and many have gone out of business. I remember when I first started at Farmers Weekly 25 years ago, there was something like 36,000 dairy farmers in England and Wales. We're now down to less than 10,000.
Really?
So that's the rate at which people are going out. Latest figures we saw show that in January, just last month, there was about 100 farmers, dairy farmers, went out of the sector because of pressure.
What do they go into?
Many retire. Some go into beef production. They're used to working with livestock, and that might provide an alternative. They might be able to diversify into some other activity, non-farming activity, but they, you know, get out of the dairy sector.
Office bonding, but with cows. So you go to the farm and there's office activities with cats. That's like, just a pitch.
Like call centres.
Yeah, like that's
milking cows together. Yeah. You mentioned the environment briefly earlier. We hear so much in the news about how farming beef and lamb is actually quite bad for the environment. Are we mainly beef and lamb farming in Britain? And are we changing, are we shifting because of environmental pressures to
Very roughly, half the country would be on arable production, crop production, half would be pasture land. And the vast majority of dairy production, beef production, would be on pasture land. There may be some farms where the animals are indoors being fed a cereal diet, but that's much more the American kind of system. Where there is production on grassland, then actually there's big environmental benefits from that. The grass and hedges and woods and trees are a natural carbon sink. So in terms of taking carbon out of the atmosphere, they actually have a positive role. It's quite often reported about the amount of methane that that cows produce through farting, basically. Yes, that's more of a problem. But from my understanding, whereas carbon, once it's put into the atmosphere, is there forever, methane does dissipate. So if you reduce cow numbers, which we have actually done over the last sort of 20, 30 years, then you're reducing the level of methane in the atmosphere, and it does dissipate.
I don't suppose, do the government subsidies reflect environmental impact at all? Not really.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And I think that's one area where the Common Agricultural Policy has had a lot of unfair criticism, that to qualify for your subsidy as a very basic level, you have to farm to what's known as good agricultural environmental condition. Mm-hmm. But 30% of that subsidy is also tied into something called greening, where you have to meet a higher level of standards in terms of environmental protection to qualify for that.
Yeah. If you didn't want the subsidy, could you, for example, buy a barn and fill it with a million chickens and just do what you like, and just get loads and loads of eggs, and they're all horrible, and all the chickens are all twisted and weird? Are you allowed to do that?
That's a loaded question.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is there a basic standard that farmers or farming need to adhere to, even if they're not looking for subsidies, or can literally anybody do anything to any animal if it turns profit?
There are some farmers that choose not to take subsidies because of the hurdles you have to go through, mm-hmm. the bureaucracy, the red tape, and if they're in a position where they don't actually need it, say they've got very low levels of debt, they've got family labour, or for whatever reason, they may decide not to claim the subsidy in the first place. That's fairly unusual, but some go down that route. There are other sectors which aren't actually subsidised at all anyway, and you mentioned poultry production.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's one of the fastest growing sectors. It's one of the most profitable sectors, and it's unsubsidised.
Oh, that sounds dodgy.
Oh, no.
There's reasons for that.
Is it because of a 99p Morrison's chicken? Is it because of welfare standards?
It's because the sector has had to be very innovative because it hasn't had a subsidy bed to lie in. It's also highly integrated, so the farmers are on direct contracts to the processors, who are on direct contracts to the supermarkets. Everybody knows what kind of margin they're getting. Mm-hmm. So they're a much more reliable share out of the overall cake. And it's a highly efficient, poultry is highly efficient at converting grain into meat. It has a low environmental footprint because it's contained within sheds. And so actually, you know, poultry is an area that a lot of people are going into.
Because one of my questions was going to be, why haven't we banned battery farms for chickens? But I guess it's a profit thing, is it?
Well, the simple answer is that we have banned battery chickens.
Have we?
But it's not quite as straightforward as that. So what is called the barren battery cage, which is literally a wire cage with five chickens in for laying eggs.
Yeah.
And be aware that egg-laying chickens are a completely different beast to a meat chicken. Two separate industries.
It's the same sort of chicken.
Completely different type of chicken.
Yeah, you don't think, like, literally it's a different beast. Yeah.
They have two legs and two wings and a beak.
Yeah.
But beyond that, and to get back to what I was saying on the battery cage issue, that those barren battery cages were banned unilaterally by the UK in 2012. Well, I think that was ahead of EU rule changes, but it was replaced by what's called an enriched cage, mm-hmm. which is a bigger cage but with more chickens. But in the enriched cage they have perches, pecking areas, and more space per bird. So it's still an intensive cage system. It's being phased out mainly at the insistence of retailers, but it's still there is still that kind of egg production.
But it's a slightly better cage. They've not just rebranded horrible cage.
Isn't it like a bijou cage? You look around and, oh, hang on, the bed's in the toilet. Well, I guess for a chicken that probably is the case.
Yeah. That's exactly how it is.
The way you make it sound is if the UK has been quite progressive with farming, mm-hmm. Outside of EU law, it seems like we are ahead of what the EU's been doing. So are you... There's all this talk about farming and agriculture being rolled backwards in terms of standards. Do you not think that's going to happen?
It's certainly the case that the UK has set the pace in a number of areas. Again, going back to the poultry one, the EU has a certain standard of stocking density of meat chickens. That's the different one to the egg chicken. Our UK basic standard is at a lower stocking rate than that. The red tractor standard is a little bit lower than that. And then you've got RSPCA Freedom Foods standards, which are lower than that. So there's a whole range of different standards. But generally, in that sector, all of the standards are above the basic EU standard. Similarly, in pig production, we banned what are called sow stalls, where the pregnant sows were kept in basically confined space throughout most of their gestation. And we banned that years ago with a fairly catastrophic effect on pig production, because we could still import. And basically our domestic production took a hit, and we ended up importing more. That's always the problem with setting the standard, because you still are obliged in the single market or even under WTO rules to import from people that have legal but lower standards.
That's amazing, because that's great to hear. That's not necessarily the image I had of British farming, which is silly, really, because you think maybe we should get that message.
Well, indeed, the industry needs to do a much better job, because, yes, of course, there are instances where somebody lets the side down and you get cases of animal abuse in pig farms or in abattoirs or whatever. They're a real minority of cases, but they're the things that you get to hear about and the things that the animal welfare lobby will latch onto and push. So, you don't necessarily get to hear the good things about the sector, and the industry does need to do a better job.
Did any of this come from the 80s BSE scandal? Have to answer
it. The drive for improved standards. I mean, that was certainly a major, major impact. The consequence of that was the standards of what goes on in the meat sector in terms of meat processing and what bits of the animal you could use for what. And there are still, 22 years later on, those rule changes are still apply today. So things that you can't do that you could have done in the early 90s.
I mean, like that whole effect that it had on the industry. I mean, like, did it change how people perceived British farming at that time? Because I can't imagine it had a positive impact.
I mean, at that time, instantly there were export bans imposed by pretty much the whole world. So we ended up unable to sell our beef abroad, which was an export product for a number of years. Interestingly, actually, the first group that banned it, although pretty much everyone did fairly quickly, was the EU. But then the first block that lifted the bans was the EU as well, because we were part of the organisation. We were instrumental in determining what the rules would be, and got to a situation where we were able to start exporting again, I think a couple of years later, apart from the French. And the French carried on banning for a number of years.
And Japan have only just lifted the ban, haven't they?
Recently.
That's right, yeah.
If you're enjoying Any Stupid Questions, because this is in the middle, why not rate and review? Wait till it's finished. Don't just stop halfway, because that also affects our advertising, I think. But when you get to the end of the podcast, rate and review it. Thank you very much.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If I wanted to be a farmer, what produce would turn the highest profit? Because I assume it's something really fancy like Romanesco broccoli.
What's Romanesco broccoli?
It's the broccoli that looks like fractals. The pointy broccoli. So it's broccoli, so it must be easy to grow. And yet you can sell it for like £3 a thing of broccoli. I don't know what it's called, a thing of broccoli.
It's probably one of those things that requires loads of water or like a special, you know.
I mean, they do look amazing. They look like maths as a vegetable. So if I was going to become a farmer, where's the money?
Chickens.
It is in chickens.
Just looking at the
good old chickens.
Yeah.
But is it in the figures? Because when they say like chickens and they have a picture of a happy chicken on the front, like, is that chicken actually happy? You know, the eggs with the happy chicken on the front? It's called, like, happy eggs.
Yeah.
Happy egg chicken.
I don't believe those happy eggs.
That's how I feel about it. Yeah. Like, is it, if you want to make a profit, is it just you got to get sad chickens and shove them all together?
No, that's not the case. The happy egg, and I agree with you that I've never seen a chicken driving an ATV before.
Yeah.
But they seem to do it pretty well.
And you would be against that?
Well, unless it was wearing a helmet.
Okay.
In those circumstances.
Well-trained chicken.
How does it reach the paddles?
Why am I so massive? I'm
a or a tiny...
So high welfare chicken would be free range. Both free range meat chicken can be profitable. Free range egg is the norm. Over half egg production is now free range. That's the norm.
Surely turkeys, like Christmas turkeys, cost a fortune. You pay like £80 for a turkey.
Yeah, well, you're paying for high welfare.
So
that's huge as well.
But chickens turn more of a profit than a turkey.
Ooh. don't have those
really
stats.
Getting into the birds.
I also realised I haven't seen, like, ducks. Are ducks on farms?
You have duck farms?
Yeah.
Both meat duck and egg-laying ducks. So, yeah, they're different birds as well. But
And how about pigeons? Do they just shoot them out of the sky?
That's how I thought they do with ducks. I was like...
Oh. Just go and catch one in a net from a wetlands park.
Free money. Grab your pigeons.
If you get a pigeon in a restaurant or pub in the UK, watch out for the lead because it will have been shot. It's a wild bird.
Really?
But in France, they do produce them in cages, in sheds. And it's a delicacy,
delicious.
Absolute delicacy.
Oh, so should we be selling all these pigeons on the streets outside in London to France as a delicacy? Yeah,
free range.
Again, it's a different product. So wild pigeon is what we would like, what I like. But
street
farm,
pigeon.
Farm street pigeon.
And they will be able to tell
the
difference.
Only my student days. the pigeons in France are an absolute premium product.
Really?
And they're all reared indoors.
Are there... deer farms?
There are deer farms as well.
Gosh, okay. Because every time I see deer in like venison, I'm always like, that must have been bow and arrow.
I assume everything is just caught in the wild, apart from like the chickens.
Chicken, a cow.
Anything old MacDonald has on his farm, I assume comes from a farm, but everything else is just caught in a woodland.
Yeah, you're like, I'm sorry, we've got venison today because we happen to see a deer. It might be bear next week.
No, they do farm deer. They have very high fences.
And are deer farms the saddest farms? Because it's just like Bambi every time. It's very sad, killing a deer.
I've never done it.
No.
Have been killed.
I'm not answering like that. Not many.
If you could have any animal farm, what would it be? Is there any animals that you really hate? Would you have a squirrel farm?
Would I have a squirrel farm? They're quite cute, I suppose, and allegedly quite tasty, but I've never tried one. For me, it'd probably be ducks. I've got a fondness for ducks.
So you want to eat them?
I don't have a problem. I'm not a vegetarian, and I don't have a problem with either eating farmed animal because I'm confident in the standards that they're reared to.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with eating a wild animal if I've shot it or killed it myself. It's part of the natural process for me.
In your car, after the badger. So I am vegetarian, but this is because I worked in a zoo and I really, like, the pigs were just so adorable. I was like, I cannot eat pork anymore. When I was pregnant, I did eat a bit of beef because, but you know, I nearly bled to death, so it's fine. It really helped, actually. But I'm with you, like, in the sense that, you know, we are animals eat animals. In the wild, animals eat animals. Mm-hmm. We eat animals. But it's the intensive farming that I have a problem with. Is intensive farming a problem in the UK?
It's a problem for you.
Because, well, it is a problem for me, yes.
It's not what you want to support through what you choose to eat.
I'm not going to eat a Richmond sausage from a newsagent. That's what I'm saying.
You heard it here first.
Or a Scotch egg I find in a garage. I'm just not going to eat them.
Delicious. I think it's more a question of husbandry on a particular farm rather than the standard, the basic standard itself. So you can come across examples of free-range farms where actually the animals are compromised because there's a greater disease challenge, for example. Whereas an indoor unit, you've probably got more control. They've got a better climate. They've got bedding that they need. So I don't think it's as straightforward as saying, you know, it's intensive bad, extensive good. You know, a lot of animals would hate to be outdoors when the wind's blowing and the fields have turned to mud. So, yeah, it's to do with standards on individual farms, which generally are way above standards that on a lot of the stuff that we import. And as I said before, often you find that if we do raise our standards into unilaterally, you still end up importing food at a lower cost. So you've got to find a compromise that works for the consumer, is acceptable for society and for government, but also doesn't completely scupper the industry by then exposing it to hormone-treated beef or chlorine-washed chicken, to name a couple of things that are in the news rather than a lot.
I was going to ask about
which again, there's answers and considerations to that.
We've been hearing a few stories about farming in America,
about
chlorine chickens, and also about E. coli in lettuces and because of runoff. And it was sort of implied a while back, I think, in the news that after Brexit, when we're not necessarily subject to EU rules, we could align more closely with American farming stands. Yeah. Is that likely to happen, or is that something that's not that likely to happen?
It'll depend on the trade deal that we get with the European Union. If we remain sort of closely tied, then we'll also have to respect their standards. Yeah. But if we're going to start pushing for our own free trade deals with the US and other players, then there's a real threat that we will, you know, have to allow imports which are currently not allowed under EU rules. And, you know, there's two sides to it. And the hormones that are used as growth promoters in American beef production and elsewhere in the world as well, plenty of other countries, technically they have a fairly clean bill of health. They've been approved by global organisations. They've been used for 30 years without ill effect. It's just not what we do here. And then on the chlorine-washed chicken, again, that's the way the Americans deal with pathogens in that supply chain. They have very different standards. So, for example, in a broiler unit here, once the flock has gone through to slaughter, the whole unit is then washed down, cleansed to very high standard. In America, they just bring the next flock of birds in and they clean them like once a year, and you may get six or seven flocks going through that shed. So they have a much higher disease pressure. But then their solution is to put the meat through a very dilute chlorine wash, which kills all the pathogens. And in terms of human safety, it's not really an issue. I mean, the chlorine that's used is less than you'll find in the swimming pool when you go swimming. If you get a mouthful of that, you don't die.
I was going to say, is it like just putting the birds through a swimming pool?
Whirlpool bits.
Yeah.
That's quite nice.
What's the farming industry's attitude towards vegans at the moment?
There's a certain wariness. Mm-hmm. I think it's understood that they have a freedom of choice, they have a right to choose. Nobody's telling them, you can't be vegan, you have to eat our meat or drink our milk. So I think farmers accept that there's a freedom of choice issue there. The big problem is the very small minority of vegan extremists who have issued death threats. They email farmers. There was a story we did last week of one group that had got hold of all the contact details of every dairy farmer in the country in a thing called Project Calf, issued all the locations of every dairy farm and encouraged their members to go and visit and film and observe and challenge, which is an invasion of privacy, but it gets more serious than that when you start getting death threats and telephone calls saying we know which school your child goes to. So that has been going on, but the farmers are obviously very angry and worried about it. But I think the only solution, some think, well, we'll just ignore it and it'll go away. I don't think it will, because it's getting a lot of traction and there are more and more people becoming vegan. It's still 2-3% of the population, which, you know, compared to the noise that is generated, is not that much. But it's certainly a growing area of the consumer market, particularly amongst younger consumers who are tomorrow's older consumers. So you can counter the arguments. There's, you know, they use arguments about the environment, and we touched on that earlier, that carbon sequestration is actually a positive from livestock production. On animal welfare, a lot of noise about ripping calves away from their mums and shooting the male calves at birth and things like that. That doesn't happen. As a general principle, it's in the farmer's interest to maintain welfare of his animals, because a sick animal is less productive and costs money in vet bills. So, you know, the farmer is motivated to look after the welfare of his animals. And then in terms of nutrition, you know, milk, eggs, meat, they're highly nutritious, pack a punch, and, you know, consumers can eat them knowing that, you know, they're getting bang for the buck.
Also, almond milk is very bad for the environment.
Yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
It uses loads of water.
Yeah.
Oh, that's crazy. That's like the paper straws in pubs now. And apparently they're just as bad for the environment.
Oh,
and they're not as good functioning as a straw.
Yeah.
What's the point of making any effort ever to be a good person?
Every time we try, it backfires.
Do you have any more questions?
I had a question about the... So this is very quickly back to the chlorinated chicken, not to press too much on it, but that's an issue of food standards in America.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't... If there was a trade agreement with America that closely aligned with America, that wouldn't change how British farms work?
That's the challenge and dilemma that we've asked government many times about that, and they guarantee that UK standards won't be lowered, but they don't guarantee that we won't import. They say they'll seek equivalence of standards in trade negotiations, but that's no guarantee that at the end of the day, particularly if we have a no-deal Brexit, the government, we think, will be looking for a quick win, which would be cheaper food. And the way of getting cheaper food is to allow American chicken or Brazilian beef in ad lib and undercut our own producers.
I guess the hopeful thing is that consumers are moving towards purchasing better quality meat, though, aren't they? I mean, there's the market for free-range and high-quality free-range eggs, organic chicken, free-range chicken, is growing. So people are making better choices.
Yes, that's true. And the industry caters for all those choices. And free-range egg production has been, you know, the great success story that 30 years ago it was 5% and now it's 55%. And that's been driven by the retailers. The industry's responded. Organic farming, which took a huge hit following the financial crisis in 2008, is now back in the ascendancy. It's still minority, but that area is growing. And who knows, I mean, if when we start looking to export, it's markets like China, Singapore, Japan, sort of the up-and-coming economies in Southeast Asia that are looking for more of a Western diet. And hopefully they will be willing to pay more for what they perceive as what is a premium UK product.
Like a Swede. Every time I get a Morrison's veg box, it's always got a Swede in it. Don't know what to do with them. What is the best waterproof jacket for a windy day?
Now we're coming to the real difficult questions.
This is what we were here for.
Couldn't possibly recommend a brand, but I know that barbers are very popular. Basically, I don't think you can... If you're a farmer, you probably can't beat wax cotton. Green, preferably. It'll protect you from the wind, from the rain, and from cow poo.
And then everybody knows you're a farmer as well.
Indeed.
Yes. So.
Why green? Is it camouflage?
So the cows can't see.
Yeah, yeah. It's only at the last minute you can jump
just
out.
Just lie down. Grab it.
I don't know, but would you want a pink wax cotton jacket?
Yeah, I would.
I thought you might.
We've got time for one more quick question each.
Is there a big rivalry between different farmers? So, like, are the butter and dairy farmers fighting against the wheat farmers? Not fighting, but are they all in the same interests, or do they have different, like, I don't know, different motivations or different, you know, pressures?
I wouldn't say there was particular fighting between sectors. I mean, typically livestock production, dairying, maybe on the west of the country, arable production's a big generalisation, but more arable farming on the right of the country in the eastern counties. You do see sort of some rivalries within sectors, so particularly organic farmers or eco-farmers against conventional commercial farmers. And, yeah, you can see some rivalries there. And they don't always give each other a very fair press.
Does it get like the Bloods and the Crips?
Yes.
Yeah. Some drive-by yoghurt throwing.
Very slow tractors.
You are in your blue scarf or your red scarf?
Inspired by Hot Fuzz, do all farmers have guns?
Yes.
Yes.
No, they don't. But shooting is certainly a popular pastime for farmers. We did a survey recently looking at well-being. That's quite an issue at the moment, both mental and physical well-being. And as part of our survey, we were asking farmers what they do in terms of recreation, when did you last have a holiday, that sort of thing. And shooting is one of the activities that they do enjoy, both from a sort of vermin control point of view, but also from a social point of view. So a lot of farmers have guns all safely locked away cabinets.
So I have two very quick questions. The first one is, how many times has Farmers Weekly been on Have I Got News For You?
Never.
Never?
But I can tell you that Poultry World, which was the magazine I edited, hence some of my questions, my answers have been based towards poultry, but I edited Poultry World for 6 years, and that was the seventh ever guest publication.
Wow.
In 1993,
wow,
which is quite scary that you think that programme has been running that long.
Yes.
But Farmers Weekly never. We're far too mainstream.
No. And my final question is, do you listen to the Beef and Dairy Network podcast? Have you ever given it a go?
Please say yes.
I am familiar with the work. And I would thoroughly recommend it to all our readers. It's great.
It's really good, isn't it?
I thought maybe like farmers would be like, ban this sick filth.
I'm not speaking for farmers, I'm speaking in a personal capacity.
Well, that was brilliant. Thanks to Philip Clark, Jack Bernhardt and Clarissa Maycock. I've been Danielle Ward and the producer was Ed Morrish.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.